USANA.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to listen in on the hearings into President Trump's nominee to be the next Attorney General of the United States of America. Among the topics that are being discussed this morning in those hearings at the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington, the Mueller investigation and the power of the president. William Barr is the nominee to be the Attorney General of the U.S., and he has written some things about the unitary power of the president, giving the president vast authority. So he's going to face some of those questions today, and also he'll be facing questions about the Mueller investigation. We're going to listen in live from Washington to the hearings of Barr's confirmation to be the next Attorney General. He's being questioned right now by Texas Senator John Cornyn, and we're going to go to those hearings right now. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa.
The memo, and do you agree with its conclusion?
I completely agree with Rod Rosenstein, and I thought the important point he made from my standpoint was not the particular usurpation that occurred, but it was, as I think he says, that Director Comey just didn't recognize that that was a mistake, and so it was going to potentially be a continuing problem that his appreciation of his role vis-a-vis the Attorney General.
As I said, the title of the memo is Restoring Public Confidence in the FBI. Do you agree that restoration of public confidence in the FBI and Department of Justice as a apolitical or non-political law enforcement organization is important?
It's critical
and needed.
It's critical, and that's one of the reasons I'm sitting here. I'd like to help with that process.
Well, Mr. Barr, I think you're uniquely qualified to do that, and I wish you Godspeed.
Thank you, Senator.
It couldn't be more important. Thank you.
Senator. Mr. Barr, we've never had a chance to meet, but I welcome you to this committee.
Thank you.
You seem like a rational person. I'd like to ask you a question.
This is Dick Durbin from Illinois, a Democrat.
When you consider what Jeff Sessions went through as the Attorney General for President Donald Trump, where he was subjected to unrelenting criticism, primarily because, as a matter of conscience, he decided he had a conflict of interest and should remove himself from any decisions by the special counsel concerning the Russia investigation. When you consider that this president has lashed out on a personal basis against federal judges who ruled against his administration, when you consider the criticism which he has leveled at the chief law enforcement investigative agency of the Department of Justice, the FBI, as well as our intelligence agencies, when you see the exit lanes glutted of those leaving the White House at every single level, why do you want this job?
Well, because I love the department. I love and all its components, including the FBI. I think they're critical institutions that are essential to preserving the rule of law, which is the heartbeat of this country. And I'd like to think that there was bipartisan consensus when I was last in this position, that I acted with independence and professionalism and integrity, and I had very strong and productive relationships across the aisle, which were important, I think, to trying to get some things done. And I feel that I'm in a position in life where I can provide the leadership necessary to protect the independence and the reputation of the department and serve in this administration.
A number of my colleagues on both sides have asked, and I'll bet you'll hear more, questions along the line of what would be your breaking point? When would you pick up and leave? When is your Jim Mattis moment when the president has asked you to do something which you think is inconsistent with your oath? Doesn't that give you some pause as you embark on this journey?
It might give me pause if I was 45 or 50 years old, but it doesn't give me pause right now, because I had a very good life. I have a very good life. I love it. But I also want to help in this circumstance, and I am not going to do anything that I think is wrong, and I will not be bullied into doing anything I think is wrong by anybody, whether it be editorial boards or Congress or the president. I'm going to do what I think is right.
You have a very nice family behind you.
Thank you.
I'm glad you introduced
Thank you, sir.
And I don't want to give your grandson any career advice. He's received quite a bit this morning already. But he ought to consider, at least for some balance, being a public defender. One of the things that you alluded to as a major issue of concern is immigration. I'm glad you said it. Our government is shut down now over the issues of border security and immigration. And the Attorney General plays a central role, which many people don't know as they look at the Department of Homeland Security for most of the action on the issue of immigration. I was surprised at the exit interview by General Kelly when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that Attorney General Sessions was responsible for the zero tolerance policy that was announced in mid-2018. And that it was because of that policy, that was one of the reasons why he was being asked to leave. That's the first I'd ever heard. Are you familiar with the zero tolerance policy?
Generally, Senator, yes.
I can tell you that it was an effort to take escorted children, infants, toddlers, and children, and forcibly remove them from their parents at the border. This policy by our government separated up to 2,800 of those children and put them into the system, the same system as unaccompanied children. The results were horrible. I saw them firsthand. And you have alluded in your opening statement to stopping people from crashing through the border, breaking and flouting the laws. Those young children, for the most part, were being brought to this country by their parents to seek asylum. You can present yourself at America's border and seek asylum legally, can you not?
Yes, Senator, you can.
So separating those children from their parents in an effort, as Attorney General Sessions explained, to get tough with families presenting themselves at the border was a policy decision on his part. Do you agree with that policy decision?
Well, I'm not sure I know all the details because one of the disadvantages I have is I'm not in the department and don't really have the same backing I did in terms of information that I had last time. But my understanding is that DHS makes the decision as to who they're going to apprehend and hold. Now, you can claim asylum, but that doesn't mean you can waltz into the country freely.
No, of course not.
Okay, and you have to be processed. And my understanding is a majority of people do not qualify for asylum. But DHS makes a decision who to hold and charge with the crime of illegal entry. And then they refer it to the Department of Justice. And I believe the department's policy, when the department says zero tolerance, they're saying whatever DHS refers to us in the way of illegal entry prosecutions, we'll prosecute. Now what is being done, because I think the administration has changed the policy, is DHS is not referring for prosecution family units that would lead to the separation of children from the family.
It's true that the president and the administration abandoned the policy after there was a public reaction to the separation of these children. I'm concerned. I want to go back to your University of Virginia Miller Center speech, which is...
It's a gem, isn't it?
It's a classic, and it goes back many years. But you described your previous tenure as the Attorney General, and you said, after being appointed, I quickly developed some initiatives on the immigration issue that would create more border patrols, change immigration rules, streamline processing. It would furthermore put the Bush campaign ahead of the Democrats on the immigration issue, which I saw as extremely important in 1992. I felt that a strong policy on immigration was necessary for the president to carry California, a key state in the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty revealing statement about a political agenda.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, because as I've said, you know, the attorney and I've spoken on this a number of times. There's sort of three roles the Attorney General plays. One is the enforcer of the law, and that the role of the Attorney General is to keep the enforcement process sacrosanct from political influence. The second one is as legal advisor, and that is in the Judiciary Act of 1789, legal advisor to the president and the cabinet. And there I say the Attorney General's role is to provide, you know, unvarnished, straight from the shoulder legal advice as to what the Attorney General believes is the right answer under the law. And then the third role is the policy role, which is law enforcement policy, which includes immigration policy. And there you are a political subordinate of the president, and it's okay to propose policies that are politically advantageous. Well, but I have to say that, you know, that was casual conversation. The point was I was pursuing a strong immigration policy even when I was deputy, long before, you know, the election was on the horizon. And in traveling around the country, visiting the border, paying a lot of visits to California, I saw how important the issue was, and I thought the administration had to be more responsive to it. And yes, there was a political benefit to it.
I just have a short time left. The chairman, our new chairman, congratulations, Graham, noted 10 years of work by a number of us on this committee on a bipartisan basis to deal with criminal sentencing and prison reform.
Uh-huh.
And the First Step Act, signed by the president around Christmas, I think is a significant departure. I learned, as many have, that the approach, the get-tough approach that we imposed with 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack and powder,
uh-huh,
didn't work.
Uh-huh.
Did not work. The number of drugs being sold on the street increased. The price of the drugs went down. The people being incarcerated went up dramatically. And we learned the hard way that was not the way to deal with the issue. And now we're trying to clean up 10 years later, more, 25 years later, from the 100-to-1 disparity. I voted the wrong way on 100-to-1. Now I know, in retrospect. You've made some hardline statements about this issue and criminal sentencing in the past. And many of us believe, on a bipartisan basis, we've got to look at this anew and not repeat these mistakes again. So I would like to hear your assurance that you have learned, as I have, that there is a better way, could be a more effective way, and that as Attorney General, you will help us implement the First Step Act and design the Second Step.
Absolutely, Senator. From my perspective, the very draconian penalties on crack were put into place initially because when the crack epidemic first hit, it was like nuclear weapons going off in the inner city. And as I think you'll recall, a lot of the community leaders at that time were saying, this is killing us. You have to do something. So the initial reaction of draconian penalties was actually, you know, trying to help those communities. And over time, and now, the same leaders are saying to us, this has been devastating. You know, generation after generation of our people are being incarcerated, have been incarcerated and lost their lives because of this, and you have to change the policies. And I think that is, we should listen to the same people we were listening to before. I supported generally strong penalties on drugs because, not just crack, because I felt the money involved was so high that, you know, you needed something to counteract that. I also said repeatedly over the years of the drug war that I felt that the head of the snake is outside the country. And the place to fight this aggressively is at the source more than on the street corner. And I used to say we could, you know, stack up generation after generation of people in prison and it'll still keep on coming. And so I always felt that, and I support a adjustment to these sentences and the safety valve and so forth. To me, the corollary is we have to really start thinking and using all our national forms of power in the sense of our diplomacy and our you know, economic leverage and so forth to get better results overseas. So, for example, now fentanyl is sort of the new crack. Fentanyl and fentanyl analogs are sort of the new crack, and they're coming in from China. So,
across the Mexican border.
Correct.
Correct. At ports of entry, 90%.
Mm-hmm. So, that's a long-winded answer to your question, which is, I understand that things have changed since 1992. I held on a little bit longer to keeping strong sentences maybe than others. Part of that was I wasn't involved in the business anymore. I wasn't at Justice Department looking at reports and studies, learning about different things in the country. I was, you know, arguing with the FCC about telecommunications rules. So,
Mr. Barr?
Yes.
That was a great answer, and it was long-winded.
Okay.
Senator Lee.
Mr. Barr.
After this, we'll break to 12:15 for lunch and a comfort break.
Mr. Barr, thank you very much for your willingness to spend time with us today and your willingness to be considered for this important position yet again.
Well, thank you.
Great to have your family here. And I can't help but comment, a lot of people have talked about Liam today, probably more than any of his other friends or classmates, people of his age cohort. People are thinking about what he might do for a living. Unlike some of my colleagues who have suggested medicine, I want to just sort of suggest what I've suggested to my three children, which is that I'm not going to push them in any career choice, which in our family means that you can be any kind of lawyer you want. Just keep that in mind with Liam. I'd like to talk to you first about civil asset forfeiture. As you know, civil forfeiture and criminal forfeiture are two very different things, two very different species of government taking someone's asset.
With this is Senator Mike Lee from Utah, Republican.
The ability to take something away is predicated upon a conviction of a crime. With civil asset forfeiture, that happens even in the absence of a conviction. There are some serious questions, of course, regarding the legality and constitutionality of civil asset forfeiture. Justice Thomas, for example, has questioned whether some of these practices are constitutional. I was encouraged to note that in your testimony in 1991, you identified this as an issue. When you testified before this committee, you criticized what you described as the speed trap mentality of forfeiture. Your point was that, quote, agencies should not feel that just because they seize money, they're going to get the money, close quote. Now, since 1991, I've seen our government, our law enforcement agencies, actually move more toward this sort of speed trap mentality rather than away from it, as many of us would have preferred. Too often, law enforcement agencies have too strong an incentive to use civil asset forfeiture in a way that lines their own coffers outside of the relevant appropriations process. So let me just ask you the question. Do you think that the speed trap mentality is a problem? And if so, is that something that you'll work to address within the Department of Justice if you're confirmed?
Yes, I think constant vigilance is necessary because, there are incentives there that should be of concern in administering the law. And I understand that there are some, people who are concerned about it have some horror stories. The people at the Justice Department have been trying to clamp down. I think Attorney General Sessions put out some guidelines that were supposed to address that. I haven't gotten into it myself. I plan to get into it and see exactly, what the horror stories are, where the problems and potential abuses are, and also whether Attorney General Sessions' guidelines are providing sufficient protection. At the same time, I think it is a valuable tool in law enforcement, and the state and local law enforcement officer, our partners, it's very important to them. So I want to make sure we strike the right balance. And once I have a chance to review it, I'd be glad to come up and talk to you about that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I understand that it's a tool that many consider valuable, but a tool that can be considered valuable for some of those same reasons. Something that's considered valuable to the government can, in many instances, jeopardize an individual right that is protected under the Constitution. We've got to be careful of that. When you refer to the partnership that sometimes takes place between state and federal authorities, this is sometimes where we see it abused. In the case of procedure known as equitable sharing, where sometimes state law might prohibit the use of civil asset forfeiture under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. And in those circumstances, those state law enforcement agencies might work with federal law enforcement for the specific purpose of evading state law that would otherwise prohibit that. So I hope that's something you'll look into as well.
Yes.
Let's talk about antitrust for a minute. Along with Senator Klobuchar, I chair the antitrust subcommittee. And as I'm sure you're aware, there are a growing number of people who take the position, who embrace the viewpoint that we should use antitrust law to address a whole host of social and economic harms, to, among other things, to ensure that companies respect the First Amendment, or to prevent large companies from becoming too big, or to shape labor markets, or to conform industries to a particular aesthetic, or achieve some other broadly defined social interest. I'd like to know what your view is on this. Are you a believer in the sort of big is bad mentality, or do you gravitate more toward the idea that our antitrust laws are there to protect consumers and should focus on consumer welfare and prices that consumers face?
Yes, I mean, generally that's where I stand, which is the purpose of the antitrust laws, obviously, is to protect competition, and that competition—it is competition that ultimately redounds to consumer benefits. At the same time, I'm sort of interested in stepping back and reassessing, or learning more about how the antitrust division has been functioning and what their priorities are. I don't think big is necessarily bad, but I think a lot of people wonder how such huge behemoths that now exist in Silicon Valley have taken shape under the nose of the antitrust enforcers. You can win that place in the market in the marketplace without violating the antitrust laws. But I want to find out more about that dynamic.
Right. And in some circumstances, a company that becomes too big ends up behaving in a way and exerting market dominance in a way that impairs consumer welfare anti-competitively. In other circumstances, consolidation can bring about lower prices and increased competition. I assume you wouldn't disagree with either of those statements.
No, Senator.
As you know, and as several of my colleagues have mentioned, President Trump signed into law the First Step Act about a month ago. This is legislation that I applaud and legislation that I've been working on in one way or another for 8 years, and was pleased to team up with Senator Grassley, Senator Durbin, Senator Booker, and others to work on that over the course of many years. As you know, the Attorney General has an important role under the First Step Act in appointing members to something called the Independent Review Commission. That Independent Review Commission will make recommendations concerning which offenders might be eligible for earned credits under this legislation and which programs will be approved. When we drafted this legislation, there were some members who were concerned that whoever was the Attorney General at the time of this law's passage and implementation might be able to undermine the effectiveness of this law by appointing members who didn't agree with or believe in the objectives of the bill. So will you commit to me, Mr. Barr, that you will appoint people to that independent review commission who are honest brokers to decide which offenders should be eligible and which programs should be eligible to participate?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. You familiar with the Ashcroft-Sessions policy, namely the policy requiring prosecutors to charge the most significant readily provable offense?
Yes, Senator.
Tell me how that should best be balanced out with the discretion of a prosecutor. Most frequently, of course, with the discretion of a local U.S. Attorney's office.
Well, I was going to say, I think the best way of balancing it out is to have a supervisor who is able to approve departures from that policy based on the specific circumstances. And there are countless different, you know, permutations of facts that might justify a departure from it. So I think it's best handled by supervisory people. But I also think it has to be looked at centrally. I'm not saying that each case has to be approved centrally, but there has to be some monitoring of what's going on because, as you know, one of the things that led to the sentencing guidelines was, just big differences in the way the laws were being applied and enforced around the country. And I think we need to try to strive for as much uniformity as we can.
But you intend to continue that policy?
Yes.
And
unless someone tells me a good reason not to.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that if you do follow it, you will defer to the judgment of the office in question in the case of determining when to not charge the most serious readily provable offense.
I won't defer to I'm not going to say, yeah, I will defer to my subordinates. I mean, usually you do defer to your subordinates, but there might be a case I disagree with, and I'll assert myself on it.
Okay. I see my time has expired. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Senator Lee. We'll take a recess to 12:15 and start with Senator Whitehouse when we come back.
Well, you've been listening to the live hearings into the William Barr confirmation to be the next U.S. Attorney General. Those hearings taking place this morning at the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Republican. The last questions were asked by Mike Lee from Utah. We also heard questions from Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois. Mike Lee is a Republican from Utah, and John Cornyne, a Republican from Texas. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa. We're going to open up the phone lines, take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. As we heard and during those hearings, President Trump's pick for the attorney general said it would be an abuse of power for Trump to intervene in an investigation he has a stake in. Barr said Tuesday at his confirmation hearing that he believes such an action would be a breach of the president's constitutional duties and could violate federal law depending on the circumstances. Barr was responding to questions from California Senator Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, in light of a memo that he wrote criticizing Special Counsel Robert Mueller's obstruction of justice investigation. Barr has said the memo was intended to be narrowly focused on one of Mueller's reported interpretations of obstruction. Barr also said his memo was based solely on public reporting and not on any confidential information. Senator Feinstein said this morning that she's troubled by Barr's expansive view of presidential powers since he will be overseeing the special counsel's investigation into whether President Donald Trump or his associates coordinated with Russian interference. And William Barr has a view of executive power that if you saw the movie Vice, you know what unitary executive power is. And Barr, at least according to some writing, has that view of the expansiveness of presidential power. Let me just read from a Slate article from a few weeks ago. Barr, a former attorney general under George H.W. Bush, writes, "Constitutionally, it is wrong to conceive of the president as simply the highest officer within the executive branch hierarchy. He alone is the executive branch," wrote Barr. And Barr derives this conclusion, "Because the president alone constitutes the executive branch," he writes, "the president cannot recuse himself from control over any federal prosecutorial investigation, including an investigation in which he has a personal stake. In other words," Barr writes, "he is constitutionally entitled to call off any prosecution, even if he, his family members, or close associates are likely targets." What Barr ignores, according to the Slate article, is that Article 2 of the Constitution, the charter for the executive branch, explicitly refutes this reading. Article 2 refers specifically to separate executive departments, so constitutionally it's nonsense to assert that the president alone is the executive branch. So those questions really didn't come up this morning. Senator Feinstein said she was going to ask those questions later. We haven't really heard Barr grilled on his thoughts on the expansiveness of presidential power, but it raises this specter. This is what Richard Nixon said during that famous David Frost interview about the power of the presidency. We're going to play this in just a moment. Here's President Nixon, after he was out of office, being interviewed by David Frost, talking about how far executive power reaches.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
By definition.
Exactly.
President Nixon's view of about executive power there. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. We'll see if that question comes up this afternoon when the testimony continues. And I don't think that we're going to be carrying the testimony here on WMNF, but it is widely available. And our phone number, 813-239-9663. If you saw that movie Vice, you know what the Dick Cheney's view was about executive power, too. Some of the other items in the news that we could talk about, and if there's something in the news that you want to talk about, this is the time to call in, 813-239-9663. State wildlife officials have removed the population of ospreys in the Florida Keys from the state's list of imperiled species. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission said yesterday that the ospreys were removed from the endangered list in December, after a review found their numbers are rising statewide. The Miami Herald reports some had argued that the Keys clan of ospreys should be classified as their own subspecies, but state wildlife officials say there's no evidence that the ospreys are genetically different. The change in designation means there are fewer rules for developers. It is still legal, though, to kill ospreys. Antarctica is melting more than six times faster than it did in the 1980s, according to a new study. Scientists using aerial photographs, satellite measurements, and computer models to track how fast the southernmost continent has been melting since 1979 have found the ice loss to be accelerating dramatically, a key indicator of human-caused climate change. In 2009, Antarctica lost almost 278 billion tons of ice per year. That was far more than what was being lost in the 1980s. 1980s, the average loss was about 44 billion tons a year. So the new loss is six times higher than the old loss. House Republicans in Washington will block Iowa Congressman Steve King from serving on any committee in the new Congress as punishment for his remarks about white supremacy. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy denounced King's remarks as beneath the dignity of the party of Lincoln. Earlier, in an interview with the New York Times, Congressman King questioned how the terms white nationalism and white supremacy became offensive. Since that interview was given, he's denied he's racist and said his remarks are being mischaracterized. Well, today, Iran conducted one of at least two satellite launches that it plans despite criticism from the U.S., but the satellite failed to reach orbit. The rocket carrying the PIAM satellite failed to reach the necessary speed in its third stage of launch, according to the Iranian government. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that Iran's plans for sending satellites into orbit demonstrate that country's defiance of a U.N. Security Council resolution that calls on Iran to undertake no activity related to ballistic missiles capable of delivering nuclear weapons. In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promptly slammed Iran this morning over the launch, accusing Tehran of lying and alleging that the innocent satellite was actually the first stage of an intercontinental missile Iran is developing in violation, Netanyahu says, of international agreements. Iran says the launches do not violate the resolutions. Over the past decade, Iran has sent several short-lived satellites into orbit and in 2013 launched a monkey into space. The U.S. and its allies worry the same satellite launching technology could be used to develop long-range missiles capable of carrying nuclear weapons. Iran denies wanting nuclear weapons. A 2015 deal it struck with world powers, including the U.S., limited its enrichment of uranium in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions. However, President Trump pulled America out of that Iran deal in May. While United Nations inspectors say Iran has honored the deal up to this point, Iran has threatened to resume higher enrichment. So, again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Government figures show the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has hit a 30-year low in the number of pollution cases referred for criminal prosecution. Governor Ron DeSantis picked his second Supreme Court justice yesterday. Robert Luck was his latest choice. He's a former Miami federal prosecutor and a judge on the 3rd District Court of Appeal. And DeSantis will pick one more justice to the U.S. Supreme Court. The latest selection, Robert Luck, who's 39 years old, has ties to the Federalist Society. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And South Florida Congressman Alcee Hastings says he has pancreatic cancer but plans to remain in office as he fights the disease. The disease is almost always fatal. The 82-year-old Democrat said in a statement yesterday that he's optimistic about his chances for survival and for being able to perform his duties. So he was elected in 1992. Alcee Hastings, 813-239-9663. So if there's something that you want to talk about, call that number and we'll start talking about it. Usually the first call or two into the show determines the direction the show takes. And Elijah writes this, Barr has said it would be an overreach of presidential powers to interfere in or obstruct in an investigation where the president has a stake in it. But it's already gone down, interference and obstruction. So now what? That's Elijah's position. 813-239-9663. Adam writes this, these hearings are basically a waste of time. Barr is just going to say whatever he thinks they want to hear. Half the Republicans are using their time to bash the FBI and investigations into Trump instead of actually questioning the guy. Barr is obviously compromised. Why else would he write and send an unsolicited letter railing against the Mueller investigation before his appointment? And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Barry in St. Petersburg for a first phone call today. Hi, Barry. What's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about the diversity of the Ron DeSantis appointment.
Okay, go ahead.
And it goes that I think Luck is Jewish, and I think the woman before on the Supreme Court was Cuban-American female. So he's getting diversity of ethnicity and sex and race, but he's not getting diversity of opinion of their philosophy. He's appointing fairly traditional conservative Republicans, which is also interesting that he's not appointing what we would call Trumpian, he's appointing kind of mainstream Republicans, but they're all mainstream conservative Republicans. They may look different, but their philosophies are very similar. So we need to not, if you're a Democrat, you need not to lower your vigilance. You need to applaud him for the diversity of color and ethnicity, but you know, we ought to also applaud that he's not getting diversity of opinion.
Well, Barry, this is the first Jewish judge in 20 years, and as you point out, the first Cuban-American judge ever, a female Cuban-American judge. One of the things that the African-American community and other communities are saying is, for the last 30 years, we've had African-Americans on the Florida Supreme Court. And now, with Peggy Quince's resignation, there won't be... It doesn't appear that there's going to be an African-American on the Florida Supreme Court.
There will be not, because he is going to take from the nine remaining members of the panel and pick one of them.
But, you know, there are people urging him to relook at the Judicial Nomination Commission and the people that first applied to the JNC and maybe look in that field for a possible African-American judge.
Well, and there's still a question about the panel. I called the governor's office, and he said the panel was complete. And remember, the bar set up a panel of 11, and the three names from South Florida were asterisked. And they were basically leading to me believe that the at-large panels were filled with six, so that there was no room for additional people for the at-large. Because Luck was, even though he was from South Florida, he was one of the three asterisks that qualified for the position that required somebody in the Miami-Dade circuit. Those three could also be picked for any of the at-larges, which are the other two were at-large. So the third remaining position, the woman who got appointed, the Cuban-American woman, was a Miami-Dade appellate appointee. Mm-hmm. The Luck is an at-large appointee from anywhere in Florida. The third and final appointment which I guess he's going to make next week, is an at-large appointee.
So is there any wiggle room? Could he conceivably go back to the people that applied to the JNC and look at that whole field of candidates? Or
no, he cannot. The JNC has sent him a panel. And the old Supreme Court under Barbara Ferrante rejected Charlie Crist. They said that once the JNC sends up, if they send 3 to 6, you have to pick from one of them. You can ask them to send more, but they don't have to.
And one final question, Barry, to you as a great caller. All right, so if you've got ideological conformity, almost all these members of the Florida Supreme Court are members of the Federalist Society or conservatives or conservative libertarians. At least that's the way it looks.
Right.
We don't know what the choice is going to be next week. So when redistricting comes up in 2020 and people look at redistricting done by the legislature and they say, well, it doesn't conform to the state amendment about redistricting, calling for fair districts, they take the case to the Florida Supreme Court and they try to challenge the districts drawn by the Republican legislature. I mean, do you think that might be the scenario? And if so, what do you think happens at the Florida Supreme Court?
Well, I think right now there was a 4-3 vote, and the three conservatives voted against the more stringent reading of the fair district. There was one member, and I think it's LaBarga, that was the swing vote, but he has swung as he saw that the three were going to leave, and a Republican governor was elected, he started voting with the conservative bloc. The other 9 of people that are potential Supreme Court justices are all Federalist Society members or acolytes. So you're going to have 6 real conservatives and 1 guy who votes like a real conservative. Now, fair districts, there is some wiggle room, and this is what people don't realize. They don't have to gut fair districts. They just got to tweak it. If you give a little bit more liberality, say 5% more liberality on drawing the districts to the legislature, you give them 2 or 3 more state senate seats and 5 or 6 more state housing. So you don't have to do a lot to give them just a little bit more wiggle room in their drawing for the formulas on fair districts, and you help the Republicans get back to their 2/3 majority.
All right, so Barry, a lot of environmentalists are cheering this governor. What's your take on the governor? I mean, a lot of environmentalists, the head of the Sierra Club in St. Pete the other day said that this governor has done more in the last 7 days than the previous governor did for the environment and for water quality in the entire 8 years that he was in office.
And I think the governor before him, too. I've been very active in supporting the Everglades Foundation. They are ecstatic. Not only is he throwing money at the problem, but he's not throwing money at it. He's spending money wisely. He's really pushing the federal government to get involved and help up on Everglades restoration, which is a massive protection for the state's water. But he's interested in water in the springs up in the Kuniak Springs and in the Panhandle. He appears to be a conservative of the conservation conservative, like a Teddy Roosevelt. But he seems to do it also from a fact that even if you don't do it as a tree hugger, that if you don't have fresh water, you don't have food, you don't have water for your animals, and you don't have water for people to drink, and then people aren't going to come here.
All right, so liberals and environmentalists might take some joy at his environmental positions, but liberals might... Go ahead.
Right, and the agriculture industry is pissed at him. And I think that he's... He appears to be sensitive there, that there's... The University of Florida did some isotope studies, which funded... track the pollution. More pollution came out of septic tanks in the south east Florida part of the state than agricultural runoff. We have a septic tank epidemic problem in Florida, and it may cost billions of dollars, but when they can find Splenda and Viagra, which are not dissolved in your system, in the water, it's not coming from fertilizer. It's coming from people who have septic tanks that are leaching into the aquifer. Man. And so that is something we are really going to have to address, and it may cost a lot of money. But if we want to live in Florida with 21 million people, we're going to eventually have to start solving problems, or we're going to deteriorate life for everybody.
And did this new governor rescind the appointment of Carlos Baruff, the developer, from the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission?
He pulled Carlos. Carlos is a friend. The only press interview he did while CRC chairman was on my radio show. But now the question is, what he did is he rescinded everybody who was not a pen to paper. So the governor appointed, I think, 84 people, 70 of them, I think, or so, were pen to paper, which means they became, on the governor's signature, to their appointment. I think there were 14 that required some sort of confirmation. He pulled back anybody that required some sort of confirmation. Now, he's going to relook at them and re-interview. Carlos is an important player in the Republican Party. He may reappoint them, but if he does, it's going to be on his terms rather than Governor Scott, so they're going to owe their allegiance to him. A similar situation is Debbie Stemmler, who at that point was very close with Brent, was the finance chair for Charlie Crist. Jeb Bush appointed her to the USF Board of Trustees. Charlie pulled it a week later, appointed her to the board, so that the appointment came from him, so her appreciation was to him, not to Jeb.
All right, so Carlos Baruff being a big money guy, making lots of donations to Republican parties and Republican candidates, this governor has to keep him happy. So he may, even though he rescinded his appointment, he may restate it.
Right. Now, the only thing is, remember, he stayed in the race, but DeSantis dropped out against Marco Rubio. So there might be a little bit of enmity there, too. Because remember, at the end of the day, all these politicians are people and have their normal human relationships.
All right. Well, we'll just reveal Barry Edwards. Thanks a lot for calling in.
You're welcome. Great show, Rob.
All right. Thanks, Barry. Good to hear from you. Barry has his own radio show locally and also is a panelist on my TV show, Florida This Week. And he is active in politics here in the Bay Area, usually working for Democrats. David writes this, I saw a disturbing story in the Ledger today. There were 14 cattle in Polk County that died recently due to toxic cattle feed. And the feed was actually made at the Purina plant in Mulberry. David says, I'm curious when the investigation comes out regarding what caused the toxicity. Yeah, I haven't read the Ledger today. David, thanks for that heads up. We hope that as you listen to WMNF, especially as you listen to programs like Radioactivity, that you learn a lot. That's the service that we provide you new information about all sorts of things, what's going on with the bar confirmation hearings and what's going on in Florida politics, doing a deep dive. Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Jan Simpson is our phone producer today. Jason writes this regarding Iran. Why is it that the United States, the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, gets to be the one who decides who else gets to have them? Writes Jason. Well, that's a good point, Jason. Thanks a lot regarding the Iran story that I read. Here's an anonymous email from the 352 area code. It says, skin color is not a qualification for the Florida Supreme Court. Actually, this is signed by Jeff in Newport Richey. You know, I think the question of who comprises the Florida Supreme Court, they have lots of power over interpreting the Constitution when it comes to education, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to redistricting. And so if you have, let's say, an all-white or all-white and Latino court, and you don't have any African-American representation, Florida has about 10, 11, maybe 14% African-American population, what does that say to those citizens that they're not represented on the highest court? Or do you agree with Jeff that skin color is not a qualification for the Florida Supreme Court? I think the court should reflect the population so that you, when you appear before those justices, that people culturally understand your argument and understand your case. But what do you think? 813-239-9663. And then here's an email from the 813 area code. This person is anonymous, and they say, I think that DeSantis is expected to make an announcement on smokable marijuana this week. So we'll find out about that. I don't know if the governor is going to do anything about smokable marijuana. So what do you think? There's a lot of issues in the news that we've talked about. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. You know, I'm curious, did you see the movie Vice? Did you see the discussion? There was a couple times in the movie that this idea of unitary executive power was discussed. And I played you the Richard Nixon soundbite just a few seconds ago. But how much power do you think the president should have? I think that question is likely to come up in the bar confirmation hearings this morning, or rather at 12:15 when they restart. But how comfortable are you with the president's power? Just reading what Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic senator from California, said today, she's She's troubled by Barr's expansive view of presidential powers since he will be overseeing the special counsel's investigation into whether President Trump or his associates coordinated with Russian election interference. You know, it's a big question. How much power should the president have? And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Gino, who's in Tampa. Hi, Gino. You're on WMNF.
Yes. On the Supreme Court of Florida, you should have an African-American, because just like you said, he would understand our plight. Now, one thing about it is that I heard that the Senate was looking for someone like
Clarence Thomas.
Right, which isn't. He isn't a representation of us. If for those of you who do not know, I would say 90%, if not higher, of Black Americans do not like him. And it has nothing to do with the Anita Hill issue.
Yeah, Clarence Thomas usually is very quiet during the discussion about the arguments for the floor, for the U.S. Supreme Court, and he tends to vote almost all the time with the conservative majority on the court. Sometimes he will write his own opinions, although that's kind of rare that he gets to write an opinion. But he tends to side with the conservatives and. He was the one who replaced the great Justice Thurgood Marshall, who was one of the most progressive people. Thurgood Marshall, of course, was instrumental in trying to get justice for the Groveland Four. And defended. Go ahead.
Thomas, actually, he didn't want, what was it that he didn't like, even though he was he didn't want us to have the civil rights. It was something to do with civil rights, even though he was a beneficiary of it. Can't remember right now what it was, but he just didn't want anyone to have these type of civil rights. But he was a beneficiary. That's how he got to school. And then all of a sudden he changed his mind. Say, well, I wish I wouldn't have done it. But he had done. He was a beneficiary. I can't remember what it was right now.
I've forgotten too. Was it affirmative action?
Affirmative action, right? Yeah. Affirmative action. He said that he doesn't agree with it, but he was a beneficiary of it. And then once he got to where he was up there, he changed his mind about it. Now, how much more, I don't know, idiotic could you be when it comes to that? He just totally just flipped. We consider him as in terminology, as an Uncle Tom. That's what we consider him as.
Mm. All right, Gino, thanks a lot. Thanks for your views. Good to hear from you. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Hi, Nancy, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, fine. Lots has happened, huh? Wow. I got a theory on this wall thing, if you'll bear with me. And Darris Beck, with his three... businesses that they're going to vote on today, since Mnuchin, you know, put the he wants the sanctions lifted on this guy.
You're talking about the Russian oligarch.
His businesses, okay. Not yeah. him, but on his businesses.
Right.
But he's still going to be in charge of those businesses. Those businesses have to do with steel, not just aluminum. They keep saying aluminum, but they're forgetting about steel. And wow, just imagine the kind of deal we're going to give them on their tariffs. If we bring in their steel to augment whatever we can bring up for steel, if they decide to build the wall, okay? So what this does is it cleans money, and it also, you know, launders money, and it also helps Trump, who I think this whole thing, he might not be working for Russia per se, but he is working to, he's got debts. He's probably not paid the first interest payment on his debt to them, and you know, that to those banks over there, and you know that's a big part of what he does. It's part of his MO.
You're saying that Mnuchin, the head of Treasury, is going to make a decision about the sanctions against Deripaska?
No, he's not. He already has. He wants them lifted. Today there's a vote to see if those sanctions, if the Senate agrees that the sanctions should be lifted.
Mm. All right, well, we'll pay attention to that. Nancy, we're out of time, Nancy.
Okay,
thanks
all
a lot.
Just threw that in. Bye.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. We'll hear one of the Tampa mayoral candidates tomorrow on the show. This is WMNF.